Good afternoon. I'm Elise Thatcher, and this is Spotlight Health from Aspen Public Radio, our series on critical health issues. Talking about dying can be really hard, and one of our guests today hopes to change that and actually improve our days and months leading up to when we pass away.
More and more of us have opinions of how we want to die, who we want to be around, where we want to be, etc. So it's just begging for a designed experience.
Later in the program, we'll delve into the world of drawings and other art detailing the human body.
People usually ask, why do we need medical illustrations when you can just use photographs or just use videos? But the amount of visual information that we can take in from photographs is far too much.
That's coming up on Spotlight Health. Dr. B.J. Miller is passionate about dying and managing pain. He's senior director and advocate at the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. I asked Miller about his interest in bringing design, a word that's everywhere these days, into the experience of dying. I spoke with him recently by Skype.
Dying isn't sort of a moment. And while there's a lot of mystery around death, There's much less mystery around the act of dying. Dying happens while you're living. You know, it is part of the deal, and we actually know a lot about it. And most people are afraid of dying. Most people I work with aren't too afraid to be dead. They're afraid of the suffering they imagine that will happen when they're dying. So again, this is an experience that happens over time, and that's something that we know a fair amount about. So you put those together, and this is the invitation to design, because we can create, at least to some degree, we can create these experiences. And more of us have opinions of how we want to die, who we want to be around, where we want to be, etc. So it's just begging for a designed experience. I mean, a quick caveat on that, Elise, I get very excited about what could be, but sometimes when I talk about design, I think it's really important to say part of what would be designed into this is space for all the things we don't know. Space, making room for anxiety, et cetera. The idea is not to, I think some people hear the word design and they think that we're going to try to put a pretty face on something that's inherently difficult. That's not true at all. This is not meant to try to sugarcoat a hard process, but to make it all that it can be. It is an incredibly profound experience too. So that's one answer to your design question. The second is, you know, there's a systems issue around how we die. Most of us die within the healthcare system, either in acute hospitals or nursing homes. And these are inventions. These are invented places. This is not just a natural process of dying. So, and in terms of the healthcare system, I think many of us believe that it's somewhat broken, and it's especially broken at the end of life, where we spend a ton of money on futile interventions and end up often causing more harm than helping. So from a systems point of view, I think the system itself needs to be redesigned. And my belief is that's going to happen from work inside of healthcare and also outside of healthcare. And there's your second reason why I'd like to invite design thinking into the mix.
And keeping that in mind, why is it important to change how we think about dying? What isn't working now? And you kind of hinted at that, but tell me a little bit more.
One of them is that most Americans would say they'd like to be at home when they die. You know, it's not a medical event. It's a deeply personal and intimate event. And it's hard to meet that out in a hospital setting. So one big chunk that gets at the problem is that most of us are not dying where we say we want to die. And that's something of a shame, because again, these are final moments, very profound for the person doing the dying, and then equally or more profound for the people who in the family and friends circle who have to live on. So there's one nod to something being broken. Another big chunk is the amount of expense that goes into the end of life. About 25% of Medicare dollars are spent in the last year of any one person's life. And that's an enormous, disproportionate amount of money that goes into sort of spastic care at the end of life, some of which is helpful, but much of which is not. So we have this problem with futile care that's very expensive. And often, the third piece of this is, often that care is not at all aligned with the goals of the patient. People end up on these conveyor belts into ICU settings and surgeries, etc., without a lot of gut checks along the way, because there's an absence of honest communication and conversation and a dialogue about what's important to the individual. So Atul Gawande gets at that in his book, Being Mortal, that there's a real problem here, a fundamental issue around medical education and how we train clinicians to navigate these transitions in care. So there's an array of problems in the healthcare system currently, and we could talk for hours about it, but those are some of the greatest hits.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this recently. I have a grandparent who's steadily getting weaker, but her mind is still very sharp, and she's kind of in that tenuous place where she needs more day-to-day care, but, you know, she lives physically in a place where there's not that many options without suddenly ending up in an emergency room somewhere and passing away there.
You got it. It's very tricky. I mean, even if your family is well-resourced and very savvy, it's still inordinately difficult to navigate all of this, all of these changes. And as someone gets closer to death and as someone's faculties begin to fail, et cetera. So there's just no, it's really, really tricky. And I guess here it is in a sense, it doesn't need to be as hard as it is. I mean, there's something inherently hard about our mortality. The systems issues that we layer on top of it, that's invented suffering. It doesn't have to be that hard.
To kind of shift gears here a little bit, you talk a lot about palliative care. How did your experience with an accident lead you to kind of that field?
Well, so I didn't ever receive palliative care specifically as a patient, but in terms of my own odyssey getting there as a clinician, you know, I went to med school not because I love medical science, but because I was interested in using these experiences that I had had as a patient, putting my expensive education to use, and that pointed me to medicine as a potential way to do those things. So I sort of said, okay, let's give it a try. And so it wasn't some abiding love in medical science, it's an abiding love in humanity. And the medical medicine and the prescription pad, and that's a sort of a bag of tricks I get to bring to the table. It's a way of being of service. I figured I'd go into rehab medicine, work with other disabled people. But long story short, I fell out of love with that, fell out of love with rehab medicine deep into medical school. And actually, I was going to get out of medicine altogether. I promised myself that since I had survived, I wasn't these injuries, I was not going to sacrifice my life. A lot of people get into medicine, become disenchanted, disillusioned with it, and then feel stuck. They've spent so much time and money training, they just say, well, I can't change now. Mm-hmm. And that's a shame. So anyway, I was going to get out of medicine, and then during my internship year, I stumbled into an elective rotation on palliative care and fell madly in love with it almost immediately, because it's a field that's devoted to mitigating suffering. So suffering is the fulcrum. And because 100% of people suffer, that means the entirety of the population. So this is a radically inclusive field. It's profound, even revolutionary, in that it revolves around the human condition rather than a disease process or an organ. So say like nephrology or cardiology. This is organized around being human. So that itself just thrilled me to see. And gave it this potential to cut across a lot of the siloed problems in healthcare. And I also was very intrigued by the idea that this embrace of the subjective realm. You know, so I can't give you a blood test to tell me, Elise, if you're suffering. You have to tell me that. You know, and this is the potential in palliative care to sort of disrupt the power dynamic and really get the patient's voice front and center is also profound. And that also means welcoming subjectivity into the mix, which is so fascinating. And our notions of health having to reconcile this sort of subjective sense where the rest of medicine is constantly trying to objectify everything.
I mean, it seems like in a lot of ways this could overlap with efforts to get a grip on the opioid epidemic, knowing that for so many of those folks, they kind of got to that point because someone somewhere prescribed them a pain medication. I mean, some of them certainly just bought the pills from a friend, but a good portion of them. And also understanding that the VA appears to be taking steps away from just prescribing painkillers for vets who are suffering from a lot of pain and looking more at acupuncture and other kind of complementary methods for pain management, really.
Yeah, there's a lot, as you point to something, there's a lot, this is obviously a complicated issue, and I want to just caveat that before I say anything, because we'll never get to it all here, and I don't want to be reductive, but to your point, I mean, part of the issue would certainly be better prescribing practices. You know, in healthcare, we've gone from when I was a patient in the early 90s, as a rule, we undertreated pain. As a rule, we didn't respect pain that our patients were going through. And that the scourge then, the negligence then was underappreciating people's pain. And I think through the 90s and into 2000s, autonomy as a fundamental bioethical principle has begun to rise. And that means really well-intended doctors will defer to their patients and what they want, including more pain medicine at times. So the pendulum swung a little bit too wildly the other direction. More disturbing is the fact that our healthcare system is so fractured and fragmented that people can, in a sense, doctor shop. None of us, very few of us, have the benefits of a really engaged primary care clinician anymore to quarterback all of our care and to see all of our care. Right now, you can just go shop it around and no one's necessarily watching the shop. I mean, certainly primary care still exists, but it's a really difficult field. There's no money in it. The work is brutal. And there's no way, in a 20-minute patient visit that a primary care doc is going to know everything there is to know about you. So the fragmented healthcare system has a lot to say, is highly culpable, I believe, has a lot to say. There's a lot of blame to go towards the fragmentation of the system. I think a third piece is the lack of mental health services. It's an outrage. We keep in this country, there's still stigma around depression, anxiety, to say nothing of more exotic things like existential anxieties, people who are just lacking meaning in their lives. This is a huge issue. So if we're really serious about moving away from focusing on disease and instead focusing on people, we really have to reconcile the social model, the social issues, the medical issues, the emotional issues. Being a human being is a very complex game, and medicine barely touches it.
In palliative care, it seems like you're addressing A, finding out from the patient if they're suffering at all, B, talking about it and perhaps the sources of it. And it seems like that's what folks who either are suffering from opioid addiction or who are treating folks who are addicted, they have to find a way to talk about suffering and how to manage it. So that's why I was thinking those fields kind of overlap in a way.
Yes, absolutely. And what you're also pointing to is a sort of a normalization. That, you know, that I think if we just found a way to skim off the shame, the shaming that we do, whether it's shaming around dying because you failed to beat that cancer or whatever else, or the shame of depression, whatever. If we remove the shame piece and saw our commonality in suffering, that alone, I think, would bring us very, very far as a society. Right now, we're still with the sort of American heroism thing, the sort of rugged individual, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, etc. Yeah, that works to a point, but it leaves a ton of us out of the picture way too often. So this just the act of normalizing suffering as a human endeavor, period, no matter what you do, I think that alone could go very far.
Well, BJ Miller, thanks for taking the time to talk.
Thanks for having me, Elise. Great pleasure talking to you.
BJ Miller is Senior Director and Advocate at the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. This is Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. Spotlight Health is our six-part series on the top current health issues. To keep up with this and other Aspen Public Radio shows like Mountain Edition, Valley Roundup, or Curated, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. If you follow Vanessa Ruiz on Instagram, you'll see pop art, jewelry, even graffiti showing the intricate details of the human body. Ruiz runs the blog Street Anatomy. She's also a trained medical illustrator. I asked her what drew her, if you pardon the pun, to the field of anatomical art.
It was a basic love of both art and science. So my background, I've always drawn throughout my entire life, but I went to school for biology. And it wasn't really until college where I discovered scientific illustration and therefore medical illustration. I never gave thought to the people that actually drew those illustrations in textbooks. I think not many people do. You kind of take it for granted that you're looking at these illustrations for their educational value, but there's actually an art, very trained artist that's behind those illustrations. So once I found out about medical illustration, I just knew that that was the field for me because of that balance of science and art, admiring the form and function of the human body, because I think the human body is one of the most fascinating machines and everyone should know about it.
And tell me more. It sounds like you already enjoyed art. You already had an artistic bent. You had already been drawing, right?
Yes. So in college, I was approached by a graduate student who was studying the Pacific tuna crab. I went to school at the University of San Diego. And she was looking for somebody to draw this particular type of crab because it had never been drawn before. And she saw that I really enjoyed illustrating, so she asked me to draw the crab for her. And it's a project that I worked on for about 2 years, drawing these highly detailed illustrations of a crab down to using a microscope to see every little hair on their bodies. And I just so much enjoyed that very technical aspect of drawing, which I had never really done in the past. It had always been cartooning or drawing the figure, but to actually look at it from a more technical, scientific aspect was really exciting.
That just sounds so wild that you ended up drawing bodies after drawing a crab.
I know. So after college, I took a year off, and because I had done some science courses throughout college, I didn't really have the art background, the professional type portfolio. So I took a year off, and all I did was study the figure. I went to figure drawing classes. I focused on drawing the hands, the feet, because in medical illustration, the graduate programs, they really put an emphasis on being able to draw the hands and the feet, which are some of the hardest aspects of the human body to draw.
So I'm curious, is there something we can learn from looking at drawings, renderings of the human body that is harder or more elusive to learn when you're in a classroom, perhaps, you know, learning in a more formal way?
Well, are you speaking of just looking at illustrations versus being lectured at?
Yeah, yep, that's probably the best way to sum it up. You know, I notice that you're constantly looking for anatomical art, and it seems like you're aware of that being a way for educating people, which sounds a lot stuffier than the way you describe it, but as a way for people to learn more about the human body than, sure, being lectured at or maybe even just our general knowledge of our own bodies.
Yeah, so I think there's two aspects of that right now that are going down these parallel paths. So there's medical illustration that seeks to clarify and simplify complex information about the body. So people usually ask, Why do we need medical illustrations when you can just use photographs or just use videos of the human body? But the amount of visual information that we can take in from photographs is far too much. So medical illustrations focus on simplifying that and only showing you the details that you need to learn at the time. So in looking, usually when you're learning anatomy, even in the classroom, you have medical illustrations in front of you, or the lecturer has medical illustrations up on the screen. And even better yet, they're actually drawing them as they're talking about them. So if you're talking about how blood flows through the heart, that's one of the most iconic diagrams, iconic medical illustrations that are out there, because you can actually see and use arrows to see the flow of blood through the heart. Now, anatomical art, on the other hand, is removed from medical education. So artists have actually taken medical illustration out of the confines of the medical world and placed it out into the public on the streets or in galleries. And now all of a sudden we look at anatomy and it's completely different from the way that we've been used to seeing it inside of medical textbooks, which you even, you know, stated yourself that it can seem stuffy and academic. So now that juxtaposition of the academic and then the more artsy pop culture side of it, it's making it a little bit more interesting for people to grasp. And whether or not they're learning anatomy through looking at anatomical art versus medical illustration, that's what I myself am studying and trying to understand right now, because the popularity of anatomical art has been rising over the past 10 years. I'm not sure if you've noticed it. I obviously live in this world, but people are more apt now to accept anatomical imagery. They don't find it as gross and repulsive anymore, because now it's on fashion, it's in interior design, it's anatomical heart necklaces. So what I'm trying to understand is, how can we now make that popularity of anatomical art come back into the academic world and ignite an excitement in the public to learn about their body?
Vanessa Ruiz is founder of the blog Street Anatomy. Let's take a quick break. You're listening to Spotlight Health from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a full version on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Continue our conversation with Vanessa Ruiz, the founder of Street Anatomy. When you describe what you do, do you ever get quizzical looks? I've never heard of anyone kind of in the field that you're in, not necessarily illustration, but working with anatomical art.
Sure. In the beginning, when I first went to graduate school, I would get those quizzical looks all the time when I would tell people that I'm going to graduate school for medical illustration. They would say, "What is that?" And, you know, I would have to slowly explain that, oh, you know, do you know the people that draw the illustrations in textbooks? Like, there's an artist behind that, and we're highly trained. And after a while, I actually got tired of having to constantly explain what medical illustration is. And at that time, blogging was becoming very popular. So I decided to look for blogs that were talking about medical illustration, or anybody talking about medical illustration, and I couldn't find anything. There were some portfolio sites out there for medical illustrators, but nobody was really sharing anything about the field. They weren't sharing their techniques or their progress in building medical illustrations, and that really shocked me, especially as a student that was going into this field and was so excited about it. So I decided that if nobody else was out there doing it, then I would start a blog on medical illustration. And the whole point was to educate the public about our field, about anatomical illustration, anatomical art. And so the name Street Anatomy came from that, this thought of bringing anatomy to the streets and taking it out of the medical realm so that everybody could have access to it. So the blog started as a way to educate the public about medical illustration. So I would write these articles, these longer posts about the different types of medical illustration, medical legal illustration. And in between all those longer posts, because they took me so long to write, I would feel the need to, you know, to post something at least on a daily basis. So I started finding anatomy represented in different ways. I started to see how artists were using anatomy in their art versus medical illustrators representing anatomy inside of textbooks. And what happened was that my audience, my tiny audience at the time, started to respond a lot more to those anatomical art images than they did to my longer, probably more boring posts about medical illustration. So I listened to my audience and started to post more anatomical art. It was so difficult to find it at the time. I would Google, I would look through books, just to find any sort of anatomical art. So the focus of Street Anatomy shifted a little bit from simply medical illustration to the way that anatomy is portrayed in art design and pop culture. So that was a great shift, because then Street Anatomy became this place to go to that collected all of this anatomical art across all sorts of styles, from street art to tattoos to film. It's become a repository for anatomical art now.
I imagine that including tattoos probably opened that up a lot.
It really did. I started this anatomy tattoo gallery, and I kept adding to it because I started finding a lot more people that were tattooing actual anatomy on their skin. You know, it wasn't the normal I heart mom tattoo anymore. It was a bleeding anatomical heart, or I found these amazing anatomical tattoos of people that rendered their muscles on top of their skin. So when you looked at them, they looked like their skin had just peeled away and revealed the anatomy beneath, which I just found so amazing. And I'm sure a lot of people found gross out there as well. But for me to see that, to see people placing anatomy on top of their skin, was really, really interesting.
Well, Vanessa Ruiz, thanks for taking the time to talk.
Thank you so much.
Vanessa Ruiz is creator of the blog and related social media called Street Anatomy. I'm Elise Thatcher, and that's all for our latest Spotlight Health episode. If you like the music you're hearing behind me right now, check out The Reflex on SoundCloud. You can listen to this and our following Spotlight Health episodes on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.